on neighborhood poverty and influenza-related hospitalizations, FluServNet, which includes the EIP sites and some others, 2010 to 2012.
Good afternoon, everybody. So I'm also a member of the Nancy Krieger fan club, so you're going to see a very similar methodology, and I also would recommend you check out her website for the Public Health Disparities Geocoding Project. So the Emerging Infections Program is a network of state health departments, academic institutions, and CDC. 2015 marks the 20th anniversary of the EIPs, so you should find your EIP friends here conference and wish them happy anniversary. The EIP network is a national resource for surveillance, for prevention, and for control of emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. We conduct gold standard surveillance for certain bacterial, viral, and parasitic diseases, as well as cervical neoplasia. FluServNet is the name of the EIP surveillance program specific to influenza. So the analysis I'm presenting today includes data from the 2010-11 and 2011-12 influenza seasons. During these years, the FluServNet catchment area included over 70 counties in the states that I'm showing here. The counties are green in the 10 EIP states. So, is my pointer going to work? Yep. So we've got Oregon, California, Colorado, New Mexico, Minnesota, Tennessee, Georgia, Maryland, New York has two separate sites, and Connecticut. And then the counties are orange in the four IHSP states. So for the study years, that was Utah, Michigan, Ohio, and Rhode Island. Since the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, CST has funded certain state health departments to do additional surveillance following EIP methods to extend the coverage of these surveillance data. So, there are several influenza surveillance systems in the United States, right? So each one measures different aspects of flu. So ILINET is able to capture outpatient influenza-like illness, which corresponds really well with influenza activity. And the weekly state and territorial epidemiologists report. They report their jurisdiction's influenza activities, which helps describe the geographic spread of influenza. However, along with certain mortality surveillance systems, what FluServNet really does, our niche, is to define the national picture of influenza severity each year. So FluServNet cases must have laboratory confirmation of their influenza infection, and that's any laboratory result for influenza, including rapid tests, but also including PCR. They must be admitted to a hospital within 2 weeks of their flu infection, and that flu infection must occur between the 1st of October and the 30th of April of each year. Now, we collect most of our FluServNet data through a pretty extensive medical record review. We're collecting patients' pre-existing conditions, their treatment that's specific to their influenza infection, evidence of bacterial or viral co-infections, pneumonia, and outcome. And then through interviews with the patients and sometimes their multiple providers, we're also trying to collect influenza vaccine histories. FluServNet data is a very rich and long-standing data set for children. We've been collecting the data since the 2003-04 season, and for adults, we've been collecting it since the 2005-06 influenza season. But just like many public health surveillance systems, we're missing socioeconomic status data for these patients. And I don't mean race, ethnicity. We collect that. We don't have a socioeconomic status measure. Luckily, we do have a patient address. So since the data set contains patient address, we're able to geocode these addresses, which meaning assigning a latitude and longitude point coordinate for each case residence, which can then be linked to, um, which can, we can link our data to any geographically explicit data set. The U.S. Census's American Community Survey is a free source of socioeconomic data available on a fine scale. We geocoded our cases to Census Tract and then could link each case to its neighborhood characteristics as measured by the census. So in this study, I'm going to use the term Census Tract and neighborhood interchangeably. So whenever I say neighborhood, I really mean Census Tract. And again, following the methods of Harvard's Public Health Disparities Geocoding Project, we chose to look at the incidence of influenza hospitalizations according to neighborhood poverty. Each census tract is assigned to a category based on the percent of the households within that tract with income below the federally defined poverty level. So this is a graph very similar to what Dr. Green just presented. The Public Health Disparities Geocoding Project has recommended categories, which we just discussed, of neighborhood poverty. This is important to have for being able to compare findings from place to place and project to project. These categories fit our population really well. So dividing the catchment area almost into quartiles. So the four categories here are census tracts with less than 5% of households living in poverty, then census tracts with 5 to less than 10% of households living in poverty, census tracts with 10 to less than 20%, and then census tracts with 20% or more of the households living in poverty. So this is the way that our 76 FluServe net counties play out according to the public health disparities categories. Now our cases, from the two flu seasons included in this study, 7,936 hospitalized influenza cases could be successfully geocoded to census tract. Now half of our flu net cases are either less than 5 or at least 65. That's pretty typical for influenza, right? This is a measure of severe flu, and influenza tends to most severely impact the very young or the very old, so that's why we're seeing these percents, this distribution. Now, every flu season is different. These two flu seasons happened to be H3 dominant, so we'd expect them to disproportionately impact the elderly. If you remember 2011-12, well, that was actually almost a non-season, so we kind of just tacked it on to 2010-11, which was a pretty decent season. So, in terms of results, when we look at incidence of influenza hospitalization by neighborhood poverty, we see that it is not evenly distributed like the population is. Incidence, so this is age-adjusted incidence, and it ranges from a low of 10.9 per 100,000 person years in the wealthiest neighborhoods or wealthiest census tracts, all the way up to 21.5 in the highest poverty neighborhoods. So that's an incidence rate ratio of 1.98. And the chi-square for linear trend is significant. So we'd seen results like this before. We had done analyses just in Connecticut data, looking at just our pediatric population for several years and looking at just at our adult population for several years, and we had seen this pattern before. Now we were seeing it when we compiled all 14 sites of data, but we didn't know if we were also going to see it at each individual FluServNet site. But we did. So each of the 14 sites is designated by its two-letter state abbreviation going across the bottom here in alphabetical order, I think. So the extent of the disparity varies by site, but in all 14 states, influenza hospitalization incidence is highest in the highest poverty neighborhoods, so that's shown by the gold or the yellow bars, that's the highest poverty neighborhoods. And incidence is lowest in the lowest poverty neighborhoods, that's shown by the blue bars. Now this is a really busy slide. If we simplify it by instead projecting everybody's incidence rate ratio, we can see the magnitude of the disparity. This is one way. So the incidence rate ratios, again, for all sites, it was 1.98, but this ranged from a low of 1.4 in Georgia to a high of 3.3 in Minnesota. This was for all ages. So we wanted to see how this would be different if we were looking only at pediatric cases. So here we have site-specific pediatric age-adjusted influenza hospitalization rates for each site. And again, every site, the trend continues. For every site except for Rhode Island, and the problem with Rhode Island was that there were only 8 total pediatric cases in Rhode Island for these 2 years, and none of them occurred in the wealthiest neighborhoods. So that's why their numbers look a little wonky. Again, if we simplify this and look instead at just incidence rate ratios, you can see for all sites except Rhode Island, because there were incidence rate ratios undefined, there was a significant, incidence was highest in the highest poverty neighborhoods, lowest in the lowest poverty neighborhoods, and the extent of the disparity varied by site. And this time, I think Colorado had the smallest incidence rate ratio, and New Mexico had the largest at 5.7. Now, this is all age groups. So beyond just children, the relationship of higher influenza hospitalization incidence in higher poverty neighborhoods was present in each of the age groups that we looked at. So this graph shows the 5 that we used. We have 0 to 4-year-olds as our youngest group, 5 to 17-year-olds, 18 to 49-year-olds, 50 to 64-year-olds, and then 65-year-olds and older. So the incidence rate ratios for each group are placed above the vertical bars. And the greatest disparity actually exists in the 50 to 64-year-olds, with an incidence rate ratio of 3.4. And the smallest disparity exists in the elderly, which we might have guessed given their Medicare coverage, right? But still, despite that, there's still a significantly higher incidence in the highest poverty neighborhoods. But perhaps Medicare is what's smoothing these first three. It is hard to say. Now, all of our FluSurveNet cases are hospitalized. So we could say they're all severe cases of influenza. But even within that, there are further measures of severity, right? So some of our cases are more severe than others. And we could try to measure that by looking at things like ICU admission, need for invasive mechanical ventilation, or even death. So let's say that patients from poor neighborhoods, maybe they're more likely to be admitted just because of care-seeking behavior. When they have a fever and a cough, they go to the ER. Maybe that makes them more likely to end up on the floor compared to if they had brought their fever and cough to a primary care physician outside of a hospital. If that's the case, then that might explain why we were seeing higher rates of hospitalization from poor neighborhoods, but we wouldn't expect to see then the same magnitude of a disparity for things like ICU admission, vent needs, and death. So we wanted to look at that. However, the incidence rate ratios for hospital admission overall, for ICU admission, for mechanical ventilation, and death, they're all pretty close to 2. We don't see a big drop-off. There is a bit of a drop-off for death. So it seems that no matter what the measure of influenza severity, there's still an increased incidence in the highest poverty neighborhoods compared to the lowest. So often, race or ethnicity is used as a surrogate for socioeconomic status. It's often the closest thing we have. But these are different things. Poverty is not race. Race is not poverty. And in at least one important way, poverty is something we could try to do something about. It's a modifiable risk factor. So nonetheless, we did want to look at our data by race ethnicity. So we wanted to see would poverty impact incidence when we're looking within each race and ethnic group. So we looked at four. And among white non-Hispanics, among black non-Hispanics, among Asian Pacific Islander non-Hispanics, and among Hispanics, the trend continues. Incidence was highest in the highest poverty neighborhoods, even within racial and ethnic groups. And incidence was lowest in the lowest poverty neighborhoods. So we're seeing consistent results any way that we slice the data. We're finding consistent results. So if this is the case, we should really be using this information to target our interventions. For influenza, perhaps the most straightforward idea would just be to target where we're advertising for influenza, where we're educating for influenza, and where we're having free or low-cost vaccine clinics each year. And we know that there is room for improvement in vaccination for influenza, even among just our data, because for once the trend goes the other way. This is, we're looking at receipt of influenza vaccination among our flu CERMET cases, and the trend actually goes down, so that people from the wealthiest neighborhoods are most likely to have received the flu vaccine, to be up to date for the current season. And the proportion of our cases who are vaccinated goes down as neighborhood poverty increases. So in conclusion, high poverty neighborhoods experienced a much greater burden of influenza, hospitalized influenza cases in our data. Previous studies have shown that neighborhood disadvantage correlates with lower resident health status. And what we've also shown here is that linking geocoded surveillance data with U.S. Census data can reveal vulnerable populations. This isn't anything that's just unique to flu. These methods can be used for anything, just like they were used for 53 in New York City. So anybody can be using these methods. They are publicly available on the Public Health Disparities geocoding website. And really, they're perhaps best valuable to be used ongoing, to be used for ongoing monitoring to see how we're doing with these disparities. And in this case, perhaps we can have the greatest impact on severe flu by focusing our efforts on increasing flu vaccine in these highest poverty areas. And I want to acknowledge all of my EIP, my IHSP, and CDC co-authors. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yeah, we have a fair amount of time for questions if there are any.
Maybe someone can take a question and then comment. Just in terms of your, so looks like you're looking at ICU admission as a measure of severity, but things like intubation and ICU admission are pretty extreme endpoints for severity. I'm just wondering whether you have looked at anything else like days of hospitalization, which would be a somewhat easily accessible thing that you find for larger fragments.
Yes, we have looked at length of stay, which actually didn't differ. It was all about the same. Most of our cases, I think our median length of stay is about 3 days. Many of our cases, though they're hospitalized with flu, it's actually not terribly severe. You know, they're there probably for dehydration. So they stay a couple nights and then they go home. And for whatever reason, length of stay didn't differ. But I think that's a great idea. If you have other ideas, please let me know.
Yeah. I want to make a comment because this is one of the first this is the first time the EIPs have tried collectively to do this, which is given that there are a group of 10 health departments receiving special funding and supposedly have as one of their mandates to sort of potentially pilot surveillance methods. This is the first time that have tried to have all of them do something at the same, something like this at the same time. I just wanted to ask him, how difficult was it to coordinate getting 10 states to geocode all their influenza hospitalization data, sort of using the same methods, and then to create the data set that you could use.
Yeah, so if you notice, this is data from 2010-11 and 2011-12, so it took some time. I mean, some of that was my fault just in taking time to do the analysis, but some of it was delays in getting all sites to get these data geocoded. Each site is different, so each site either, you know, in Connecticut we have an academic partner that pays for our ArcGIS license, so it's simple for us, but other sites not so much. It might have taken them time to identify their people in environmental health that had those skills, or get their Maven geocoder up and running, which would do their reportable disease data. Each site was its own sort of private nightmare. And the way that we decided we would handle the data was that it wasn't an option for them to just send me all of the, you know, identified data, of course. Each site had to geocode on their own, and then send just the census tract ID with their otherwise de-identified data to CDC. And at CDC, we luckily had a really great data coordinator, Alejandro Perez, who is no longer with the Flu ServNet program, who really made it possible. He's the one that cleaned all that data, that talked to sites who were having trouble geocoding, walked them through getting their overall rates. I mean, overall, so our geocoding success was 96%, but that was with a lot of help, I think, and problem solving and troubleshooting on the part of Alejandro. He then pulled all these data together and just handed me one data set containing all 14 sites data, and that was huge. So
right.
It takes resources.
And what about denominators? I can point out that you can see from the maps that none of the surveillance systems cover a complete state, because there's a huge number of influenza hospitalizations each year. So in Connecticut, it's just for that time period, it was
two counties, yeah. I think, then, yep.
And some have up to 17 counties, so you have to actually separate that out from the whole state database. So that was another thing, too, because if you thought about all the permutations you needed, if you wanted to look at it by age, race, sex, and neighborhood poverty and four categories, that's actually a lot of little denominators to create.
It's an awful lot, actually, yeah. It's a lot. Once you've done it once, it's easier. But if you were to say, do what New York had done with New York City had done over a longer period, where we would need multiple data sets from the American Community Survey, again, it would have been another layer of what do I want to say? Complication, I guess. But it was a little bit involved. But it got all sites to pose the question, could they share census tract data? Some of them had to bring it to an IRB or an HIC for the state to get permission. But they've done it now. So now that they've done it, we're not going to let them stop doing it. And we should be able to do this for other EIP pathogens. At least it can be done. Look, we've done it. Let's do it some more. Yeah.
Hi. I was wondering, did you explore comorbidities, whether the higher poverty area size population would mark for comorbidities and that could explain the higher cost positioning?
Yeah, we started a little bit. I have one slide. We started to look, this was Jim's idea, you know, could the higher mechanical ventilation be explained just because there's higher asthma among those cases? And there is higher asthma among those cases, but it doesn't explain all of it. So I think, yes, there would be higher comorbidities for certain things, but I'm not sure that it would explain away the trend, at least not the comorbidities we collect. We don't collect everything. We collect things that we think might be related to.
Does this slide require age-specific asthma by neighborhood poverty level?
No, this is asthma among our cases.
So
It's incidence of hospitalized flu who required mechanical ventilation, and then within that group, who had asthma and who didn't. Does that make sense?
Like the proportion of
it's a
cases.
Yeah.
And the second question is the main recommendation of encouraging influenza vaccination, but often it's not very effective, especially in the elderly population. So I was wondering if you have thoughts about other interventions that might be more impactful.
I wish I did. No, in terms of influenza, I mean, the CDC mantra is that vaccination is the best method, but it's really because it's the only method, and it's not very good.
Antiviral promotion?
We early antivirals, so almost a lot of our cases do get antivirals, and we can look at that, whether it changes over time, but so many, like a really high proportion of our cases get antivirals because they're admitted with their infection and all the hospitals have it.
But do you think it's antiviral within 48 hours of
symptom onset? No, but none of our cases. Well, we could look at that. We could certainly look at that. So a really high percent of our cases are covered. They almost all get Tamiflu, at least in Connecticut, I can say. And they almost all get it within the day of their positive flu test because they're admitted. But I should look at and see about timing. And I think we should look and see, we could look at delayed care because we also have an onset of symptom date and look at the time between onset of symptoms and admission date, or test date, might be better. So again, also, which I didn't mention, these are cases that are hospitalized with flu. They're not necessarily hospitalized because of flu. So I'd probably look at the time between symptom onset and test date.
I just had a quick comment in reference to the last question. One thought that I just had is perhaps we could target employer sick leave policies as not being as punitive as they are now for the lower paying jobs.
Totally.
Because, before go to work because they have to go to work for the money and because they fear that they will lose their job. So that's
a great point.
Because
right, not just flu specific,
yeah.
Right.